Writing can help us build empathy and compassion because it encourages us, even if it's just briefly, to see the world from somebody else's perspective. As readers, we rarely have to imagine the world from the perspective of a lesbian granny. And I wondered, was that one of your motivations in putting together these fables?
That's a lovely way of putting it. Yeah, yes, I suppose it was, really, because, you know, even though lesbians are not as invisible in literature as they, certainly as they were when I was a young woman, they tend to be feisty young lesbians on TV, or the women of my generation who fought and struggled for liberation, I suppose, have sort of faded into being old ladies, and you know, one old lady and another old lady. Well, you know about old ladies. They're all the same. They all look the same. They're knit, and so I just wanted to challenge that a bit, I guess. Yeah.
When Rosanna Mader launched your second collection of fables, she said something that really struck me, and I just want to quote a little bit from the speech she gave. Rosanna said, "As a queer person, unless you're lucky, you don't have queer relatives, no queer grannies in the family." And she goes on to say, "Julia and Anne feel like my adoptive queer grannies, and I hope that my grandmothering might look something like theirs someday." I guess I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that and to think about what it means to you to have your characters act as models for people who may not otherwise see their story or their futures perhaps reflected back to them.
Oh, that is so lovely. Who would not want to be an honorary granny? That's lovely that Rosie said that. I don't know if they're models of virtue exactly.
Okay. <That's fine. laughs>
I hopefully they're real, and their relationship with the kids is real. You know that thing Margaret Mead says about grandparents and grandchildren, that why they get on well together is that they have a common enemy.
So they're subversive. I love it.
Yeah, and I like the thing that Rosie said about not having queer relatives. In fact, I have to say that I did have, there were friends of my parents. I don't know that the word lesbian was ever used. They were, I thought they were young. Because they didn't have children, I thought they were much younger. Of course, I realised later they are contemporaries of my parents, would now be, you know, approaching their 100th birthdays. Mm-hmm. But they were really interesting to me because they didn't have children. They had lots of books in their house. They're both academics, actually. And it was fascinating. They were outside the sort of usual model. I liked them. And they spoke to me as though I was an adult, you know, which the parents of the children around me spoke to me as another child, of course. Mm. But these two didn't speak like that. They spoke to everybody in the same way. They spoke as though everyone was an adult. That was kind of nice.
What is it like for you to have these characters, which I'm sure draw on, you know, your life and your experiences when you're constructing them in their stories, but to have a young person say that they relate to these characters that in a way you've invented as a model? I mean, that's...
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it? It's really lovely. Yeah, I'm touched. I'm honoured.
One piece of feedback I always get from listeners who listen to our show is that the fables are funny and they make them laugh. I wonder, just to begin, I've got a couple questions about this. And for example, I don't think I'll ever forget the fables where the grannies talk about merkins. I think I laughed out loud in the studio. My first question is, have you heard this feedback before?
Yes. I have, yes. I when I recorded the first lot, you know, this is the second lot, and I recorded the first lot with somebody who just was doing it, pretty much treating it as a job, and I was alone in the studio, and I was feeling a bit sort of flat, really, and finally at the end of one episode, he turned off the mic and then he roared with laughter, and I was so reassured. I thought, oh, it's okay. He's just doing his job, but he is enjoying it as well. So that's good.
Well, the text is funny, but I also find there's something about your delivery. That's like, it's just, you're just telling it straight. And there's something about that that I find very funny as well.
Oh, good. Yeah. Oh, that's good. Yeah.
What do you think about using humor as a contradiction, a way of getting someone to think differently? It's a more subtle way of doing that, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is, we know this about political cartoons, you know, it's always the way to get under people's defences. I was thinking earlier today about changing hearts and minds, you know, that's what we've been trying to do in the environment movement forever. Just trying to get people to think a bit more and or think differently or see things differently. I'm always on a crusade, really, some sort or another. let me come out as being as a crusader.
Listeners will be
and yeah, it's the getting people to laugh. I don't know whether you've seen that current graffiti from a wall somewhere. It's obviously been painted on the wall, and it says sorry in big letters, and then it says the lifestyle you ordered is currently out of stock.
A lot of people coming to grips with that at the moment.
There've been some really lovely, such inventive ways of just it's that moment when you laugh that sort of frees up your brain a bit or something, isn't it?
I totally agree. Yeah. And it is, my last question is a little bit different. I was thinking about the writing industry, and you tell me your thoughts on this, but I see what I'm about to say as something that's imposed by the writing as an industry. I think the writing industry imposes all kinds of labels on authors. For example, I think there's a very old and false, I would say, distinction between literature and popular fiction.
Yeah.
Labels are tricky, though, because I think sometimes they can help form a public. They can let a readership know about an author. So it's a way of, in some ways, creating a community. And other times it can constrain a writer and actually limit their visibility. And I wondered, how do you navigate this, or what do you think about this in your own writing?
Yes, that's very true. And I think, you know, the first thing that I had published was a serious novel. And then I was writing the next sort of more or less serious novel, and I started writing the fables in between as a sort of palate cleanser or just for fun or something. They're sort of offcuts actually from the second novel. So my publishing history is I had this serious novel, more or less serious novel published, and then this collection of fables which are illustrated and funny and lesbian and or gay lesbian, etc., etc., really. And so the bookshops didn't know where to put them, you know. Is that on the kids' shelf, or where's that supposed to be? And I think also in terms of the literary world, I think possibly, I mean, it's hard to say, maybe the first book just wasn't good enough, or the second novel wasn't good enough, didn't cut it in the literary world anyway, nobody reviewed it. But I think that might be partly because I've, you know, my identity as a writer is a bit weird. I like, you know, I write these funny little stories, and then I write a serious novel, which maybe people think that's meant to be funny too. Hopefully it is in parts.
Well, it's tricky, isn't it? Like,
it's very tricky, yeah. And mainly you just can't worry about it. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'd love to win the Booker Prize. You know, I think it'd be fabulous. But I'd say it's probably not going to happen. And there's no point lying awake at night worrying about it, really. I think that's, you know, that's the thing for new writers. You just have to get on and do whatever it is that you want to write and not worry about how it's going to be received.
On this, and this may be an unfair question because it's a short question, but it's a big topic. I wondered what motivates you to write?
I've always wanted to write. When I was about 10, I think, I remember sitting in this particular class, I can picture the classroom, finishing my composition about, you know, the magic well or whatever it was, and thinking, I'm going to write books when I grow up. And the message I got from my father in particular about writing books is that I had to do something serious as well, because only the best writer in the world can make a living writing books. I have wanted ever since to say to him, how did you know I wasn't the best writer in the world? You know, it was a pretty good composition about a magic well. Anyway, it's all I've ever wanted to do, and finally I got round to not worrying about whether it was going to be the best in the world or not, just doing it anyway.
Well, we're certainly glad you did.
Thank you, Peter.